This is Fresh Air Weekend. I'm Terry Gross. I'm too old to have grown up watching Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, but I love the new film, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers. My guest is the film's director, Marielle Heller. She also directed one of my favorite films from last year, Can You Ever Forgive Me? She previously joined us to talk about her first film, The Diary of a Teenage Girl. The new film is inspired by the story of Rogers' relationship with journalist Tom Janot, who was assigned to profile Rogers in 1998 for a special issue of Esquire on American heroes. Janot says the assigning editor thought it would be amusing to have him, a journalist determined to say the unsayable, write about the nicest men in the world. But talking with Rogers changed Janot's life. Janot wrote a new essay about his relationship with Rogers, published in The Atlantic, to coincide with the film's release. He writes, "A long time ago, a man of resourceful and relentless kindness saw something in me that I didn't see in myself. He trusted me when I thought I was untrustworthy, and took an interest in me that went beyond my initial interest in him. He was the first person I ever wrote about who became my friend, and our friendship endured until he died." In the movie, Tom Janot's name is changed to Lloyd Vogel. His personal story is changed, too. Let's hear a scene from the film in which Lloyd is interviewing Rogers. Lloyd has a bloody cut and a bruise on his face, which he told Rogers he got from a softball game. But he really got it at his sister's wedding when he got into a fight with his estranged father.
This piece will be for an issue about heroes. Do you consider yourself a hero?
I don't think of myself as a hero. No, not at all.
What about Mr. Rogers? Is he a hero?
I don't understand the question.
Well, there's you, Fred, and then there's the character you play, Mr. Rogers.
You said it was a play at the plate. Is that what happened to you?
I'm here to interview you, Mr. Rogers.
Well, that is what we're doing, isn't it?
Marielle Heller, welcome to Fresh Air. Congratulations on the film.
Thank you.
What did you do to help Tom Hanks embody Mr. Rogers in the movie?
I mean, the positive thing going into this was obviously the way the public feels about Tom Hanks has a similar quality to how we feel about Mr. Rogers. So there was a warmth that we were starting with. There was so much that was already done there. But the truth of the matter is Tom is a very different person energetically than Mr. Rogers. He's very funny. He's very charming. He's actually got like a loud, booming voice and walks into a room and you know he's there. He shakes everyone's hand. He cracks jokes. He's boisterous. He's really vibrant. And it's never awkward when you're talking to Tom Hanks. I've never seen him have an awkward conversation with anybody. And what we figured out in our research about Fred was that he really was comfortable sitting in silence and awkwardness. And he would ask questions to people, and he would wait for an answer no matter how long it took, and he wouldn't fill that silence in. And he had a stillness to him, too. So a lot of what I had to do, especially in the beginning, was to kind of rein Tom's natural buoyancy back and settle him into a kind of zen-like state where he was being hyper-present in every moment.
Did you watch Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood as a child?
I did.
So is there anything that he said or did that you remember from your childhood?
I have very clear memories of loving the part of the show that was in his house and then feeling scared of some of the puppets in the Land of Make-Believe, and I think particularly Lady Elaine.
What scared you about her?
Well, she looks like a witch. She's got like this burnt nose and burnt cheekbones, and she had this very scratchy voice, and she was terrifying. I think she was terrifying for a lot of kids. And you know, I've rediscovered the show now as a parent. I've had a very different perspective on it now that I'm a parent, and I can watch it with my kid. And we also, the first way we really came to it was through Daniel Tiger's Neighborhood, which is the modern day incarnation of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood that the Fred Rogers Company makes. and it's all based on the teachings of Fred Rogers, but it's an animated show. And that show has just been the most incredible thing for my kid and for me. And it's been the thing that's kind of, that I was reconnecting to before I even was signed on to this project. That was the first show I let my kid watch. And it kind of got me back in touch with Mr. Rogers from a different adult perspective.
Tell me more about that adult perspective on the show.
I think I have a memory of thinking that the show was just all happy-go-lucky or something, or just easy. And then as an adult looking back, I realized that he wasn't afraid of any of the hardest parts of childhood or talking about the most uncomfortable things. He tells kids the truth. I mean, that is a radical notion, but he tells kids the truth. And I was blown away going back and seeing the topics that he was covering on his show. I mean, I had this really painful experience of watching the episode about death with my 3-year-old at the time, which it's kind of, it was such a profound experience. We were having a snow day, and so he was home from school, but it was a day that I had kind of set aside that I was going to watch a lot of episodes of Mr. Rogers. So I asked Wiley if he wanted to watch some episodes with me, and I let him pick out based on the kind of thumbnails on the internet, and he picked the fish one because he's very obsessed with underwater stuff, ocean stuff. But I knew, just looking at the icon, it's the fish one. This is the episode about death. And I thought, oh, are we going to go here? Okay. And so in the episode, Mr. Rogers goes to feed the fish, and one of the fish is dead. And he tries to revive it, and he puts it in some salt water, and he sloshes it around, and it kind of limply sloshes around, and he says, oh, it looks like it's moving, but it's not actually moving. And then he buries the fish, and he tells this story about his dog, Mitzi, who died when he was a kid. And I just watched my kid watch this episode, knowing that we hadn't spoken really very much about death. And as Mr. Rogers is telling the story about the dog dying, Wiley looks at me with this kind of skeptical look and goes, dogs don't die. And I had this like Mr. Rogers in my head and went, well, no, dogs do die. And I told, I guess what's a little bit of a stretch of the truth, but I said, you know, when they're very old and their bodies are tired, you know, dogs do die, and cats die, and we have 2 cats. And he looked at me and went, cats? Cats die? And I said, yeah. And he said, but we have great cats. And I thought, oh, God, what have I opened here? And then I pulled out a picture of one of our cats who had passed away when he was a baby, and I said, you know, remember I've told you about this cat who died, who's buried in the backyard, and you know, I believe, everyone believes different things, but I believe when I want to visit him, I can go to the cherry tree in the backyard and I can visit him. And I could see kind of wheels turning. And we kept watching the show for a few minutes. And then Wiley turned to me and he goes, Mom, walruses don't die. And I said, well, walruses do die. And he started wailing in a way that I had never experienced before. He like, it felt like he was weeping for all humanity or like the entire universe and just asking me if we could bury all the walruses in our backyard so we could visit them. And I held him and I was crying and all I could figure out to say was, I know this is, hurts. I know this is so painful. I don't know what to say, but this really hurts. And then later that night, as I was putting him to bed, you know, the dreaded question came, which was, well, what about people? You know, people don't get, the way he said it was, people don't get dead, do they? And then we had our kind of second round of weeping that happened and that came out of this episode of Mr. Rogers. And I don't think I handled it great. And I sort of felt, I still feel sort of guilty for how this all came up, because I felt like, was it too young for us to kind of go there? But I also felt like all I had to guide me was Fred telling me, you know, we let the kids guide these conversations, listen, and tell them the truth. And so that's what I tried to do.
It's an amazing story. I'm just trying to figure out what I want to
It was also one of the first stories that I told Joanne Rogers when I went to Pittsburgh. I'm just remembering,
too. Oh, what did she say?
I think we sat in her living room and she teared up and we kind of held hands as I talked about it, because it had just happened when I talked to her about it. And then she made a little video for Wiley, not about that, but just saying hello.
Do you remember how you learned about death?
I remember my grandmother's husband dying, but I think I was older. I think I was 7 or 8 when he died. But I remember that being the first real person I knew who died, and that my parents didn't let me go to the funeral, and I remember feeling like it was really unfair.
You wanted to go?
I wanted to go. Like, I felt, and I think about sort of Mr. Rogers in that way of, like, I felt like a full person, you know?
Mm-hmm.
I felt like I was having as big of an experience as everybody else, and why wasn't I allowed to go to the funeral? And I think they were trying to protect me.
Was it upsetting for you to learn that such a thing existed as death?
Oh, yeah. Yeah. I mean, I was one of those kids who thought about death a lot. And we had the big earthquake in the Bay Area in 1989.
How old were you then?
10.
Mm-hmm.
But that really, it scared me in like a deep, dark way. You know, it really shook my sense of what could happen in the world. It was just the first, my brother was trapped in a warehouse and we couldn't get to him in Oakland across a bridge. And we didn't know if he was okay. And you know, friends of mine, their parents were in San Francisco and the Bay Bridge had collapsed and we didn't know if they were okay. And there were people who were part of our community who died. And it was just so chaotic. It was just the end of the world. It felt like the end of the world at the time. It really did. And it definitely, it's still something that has meant, you know, meant something in my bigger emotional life that I'm still dealing with in therapy. And, you know, I think back on myself as a kid and I'm like, I see it in my kid. I think that's why this experience of showing him that episode was so, I just felt for him so much, because I remember what it was to be the kid who was thinking about the kind of darker questions of life and while other people weren't. But now, you know, I had this experience when I was preparing to make this movie before I went to Pittsburgh. I went to a talk at the Buddhist Zen Center in Brooklyn. And I think I had this idea in the little I really know about Buddhism or Buddha, where I was thinking that somehow if you are very enlightened, that you're very peaceful, that you're at peace, you're sort of happy. And this woman who was giving this talk said, the goal of Buddhism is not pure peace or to never feel any pain. The goal is to feel all the pain. And that made me think about Fred at that time, because all of the things we were hearing in the research about Fred was that he would empathize to such a great degree with the people he came into contact with. He would meet a stranger on the street and they would pour their heart out to him about what they were going through, and he would almost hold it like a vessel. Like he just became this great vessel for other people to pour what they were experiencing into. And and I think he felt it all. He was present in the pain of the world and not denying it.
And he grew up with a lot of illness. I mean, he was a sick child.
Yeah.
He was
yeah.
often isolated. That's how he started doing voices, like voices for his puppets. So.
Right. His parents were so nervous that he was going to be kidnapped. They had him chauffeured to school so that he was even more isolated from his friends.
Oh.
Yeah. And I think he was in his own head a lot in that way. But I think he also was very he spent the rest of his life, therefore, trying to be super connected to other people rather than being so separated from them.
I want to play one of Mr. Rogers' songs that you use in the film. I particularly like this one. It's the one called "What Do You Do with the Mad That You Feel?"
Yeah,
and it's a song all about learning to control yourself when your emotions get out of hand. And I think this is a song that most of us adults should learn by heart too. So this is the real Fred Rogers singing it. Here we go.
What do you do with the mad that you feel when you feel so mad you could bite? When the whole wide world seems oh so wrong and nothing you do seems very right. What do you do? Do you punch a bag? Do you pound some clay or some dough? Do you round up friends for a game of tag and see how fast you go? It's great to be able to stop when you've planned a thing that's wrong and be able to do something else instead and think this song. I can stop when I want to, can stop when I wish, can stop, stop, stop anytime. And what a good feeling to feel like this and know that the feeling is really mine. Know that there's something deep inside that helps us become what we can. For a girl can be someday a woman, and a boy can be someday a man. It's true.
Okay, that was Mr. Rogers. Do you play these songs for your son?
I do. That one I play for my kid all the time. That song sort of became like our thesis for the whole movie. This idea that so many of us don't actually have practical ways to cope with our feelings. And, you know, it was a song he quoted when he did that famous hearing in front of the Senate where he got money for PBS. But also, it was a song that we put in the movie specifically because it felt like it was telling the story that we were trying to hit on with this movie, which is about this grown man who really hasn't figured out his own coping ways. He hasn't figured out what to do with his own mad, and what does that mean? What type of a man is he then?
So I read that when you were making A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, you kept the shooting to a limited number of hours a day.
Yeah.
So that people like you could get home and, you know, put their kid to bed or just, you know, like spend some time with family. So Can You Ever Forgive Me, your previous film, came out last year.
Mm-hmm.
What's the difference in age, in the age that your son was, between that and the new one? And also, what did you learn from making your first film about what you needed in your life and in your family's life in order to keep doing this and not feeling like you were a neglectful mother?
When I was making Can You Ever Forgive Me, I think Wiley was two, and I would leave in the morning when he was asleep, and I would get home and he would be asleep. And even though I was shooting in New York City where we live, I felt like I was just gone. And it was really hard. It was really, really hard on all of us. It was hard on my husband, it was hard on Wiley, and it was hard on me. And I felt, over the course of the next year, people were constantly asking me questions about, like, how can we have more women directors? Why is it so hard for women to direct movies? Like, what do we need? And I thought, well, one of the things we need to stop pretending is not true is a lot of us are moms, and how do we make it more sustainable for those of us who are parents to do this job? It's really, really hard, not to mention the fact that there were a number of stories about crew members dying after 18, 20-hour days driving home long hours. You know, I just started to think, like, this is a pretty unsustainable life that we choose to live. And production particularly is really insane. There's this sense of that you have to kind of kill yourself in order to do this job well. And Melissa McCarthy was the one who actually said to me, have you ever shot French Hours? Which we call them French Hours, but it's not what they do in France, I've since heard. In France, they take like 4-hour lunches with wine, I guess. But the idea behind French Hours is that instead of doing a 12 and a half or 13-hour day with a lunch break in the middle, you do a 10-hour straight day. Everyone kind of eats food throughout the day anyway on a set. Nobody's going hungry on a film set. But you work straight through, and then you're done. And for me, it was the difference between getting home to put my kid to bed or not. So it was, you know, 7 to 5 or 8 to 6. It was most days out of the week. And we didn't do it every day of the filming, but we did a large majority of the days. There are certain days when you have like a big move or the schedule just makes it impossible to do that. You really need the longer day. But a lot of days we found it to be just as efficient. If we were in the same location, not taking a break in the middle of the day, shooting less hours, but you don't have this kind of dip in momentum that happens when you take a lunch, I found it to be just as efficient. And so it was something that I started talking about really early because I said, you know, I don't think Fred Rogers would want us to make a movie about him where we all abandon our kids in order to make the
movie.
Yeah. So how do we do this? How do we find a way to do this? And I was just lucky that everybody who worked on this movie was really game for this idea. Pretty much everybody involved had little kids or remembered what it was like when their kids were little. And a lot of us had kids under 5. And so figuring out a way to make that happen became a huge priority for me. And it worked great. And I found that the actors loved it too. Chris Cooper particularly said to me, you know, I hate taking lunch when we're in the middle of a scene. I hate breaking the momentum. I don't like going off and eating a big plate of potatoes. You know, I come back and I feel like I don't remember how I was feeling or I can't remember my lines. I don't eat anyway because it just distracts me. And, you know, I often would find that my script supervisor or my DP or I would end up having meetings or working through lunch anyway. Nobody was really taking a break. So it wasn't actually functioning as the break that it was supposed to be. So this became just sort of a mission for me and something that I want to talk more about. I want to talk to the unions about. I want to talk both to the director's union, to the crew unions, to everybody about this idea that this could benefit all of us, that it is a way that we can get more parents as directors, because I think for a lot of us it's the difference between this being a sustainable lifestyle and it not, but also that it's safer and it could benefit all of us.
Well, it's been wonderful to talk with you. Thank you so much for this interview and for the movie.
Oh, thank you, Terry. It's such a pleasure to talk to you.
Marielle Heller directed the new movie, A Beautiful Day in the Neighborhood, starring Tom Hanks as Fred Rogers.
Won't you please? Won't you please? Please, won't you be my neighbor?
My next guest, Robert Pattinson, became a teen heartthrob after starring in the 2008 film Twilight as a very attractive 17-year-old vampire. He was in the sequels, too, but he steered his career in a surprising direction, pursuing out-of-the-mainstream films by directors he admired, like David Cronenberg, James Gray, the Safdie brothers, and Werner Herzog. Now he's in two new films, The King, which is on Netflix, and The Lighthouse, which is in theaters. The Lighthouse, directed by Robert Eggers, is a two-character story. It's set in the 1890s in a lighthouse on a desolate rock off the coast of New England. Willem Dafoe plays the old lighthouse keeper. Pattinson plays his young apprentice. They're alone together. The only other life around is the seagulls. As the two men are hit by a fierce storm, they begin to lose track of time and to lose their minds. They assault each other verbally and physically. The film is shot in shadowy black and white, giving it the look of an early horror film. And like horror films, there are some supernatural occurrences, or maybe they're hallucinations. Let's hear a scene. Defoe's character has been the verbose one, but after constantly insulting and mistreating Pattinson's character, Pattinson, the apprentice, finally explodes.
You sound like a parody. Giving and nagging orders like a spinster school mom, when all the while giving the station and this deck is all wrong.
Yourself.
Well, it's all horse. Your leg and your sea life, all of it. And if I hear one more word of horse coming out of your foul, rotten tooth, smelly old mouth.
You damn.
Shut your mouth! I finished yet? You think you're so high and mighty just because you're a lighthouse keeper? Well, you ain't a captain of no ship, and you never was. You ain't no general. You ain't no copper. You ain't the president, and you ain't my father. And I'm sick of you acting like you is.
sticky laugh, snoring, and your god farts. Your god farts!
Okay, Robert Pattinson, welcome to Fresh Air. You spend so much time in this film getting abused by the weather and getting abused by Willem Dafoe and by seagulls. Mm-hmm. When you signed on for this movie, did you worry about how unpleasant it was going to be?
No, I think there's definitely a part of me that's somewhat masochistic. I think it makes it easier for me when in terms of performance stuff where there's a lot of elements pushing against you, and so you're just reactive by default.
You've made such interesting and offbeat choices in your career, going from, you know, the incredibly successful franchise series Twilight to films like Damsel, and working with, you know, David Cronenberg and Werner Herzog. After Twilight, did you have a long talk with yourself about, like, what direction do you want to head in? Because, you know, you'd become such a heartthrob, and that's not the direction you chose to stay in.
Not really. I felt a little bit nervous when it finished because I'd basically just done a movie in between each of the Twilight movies, and I just kind of worked consistently for 6 or 7 years or something. And then when it stopped, I kind of felt a little bit more nervous to do more experimental stuff because I didn't have the safety net of doing another sequel, which would basically reset everything afterwards. But then right around that time, I got offered this movie with David Cronenberg called Cosmopolis, which I still, like, absolutely love that movie. And I thought it just felt so against the grain of everything that was coming out. And there's something really exciting. I mean, I remember being in Cannes with David Cronenberg the night, I'd never been to Cannes before, and I'd grown up loving, my film taste is from Cannes, and every year when it came around, I would love seeing and read the newspaper to see what was nominated, and I would try and be getting all of the DVDs, everything that had been nominated for Cannes every year. And I remember being with him, and I was very nervous, and he said, and I was like, oh, how do you think it's going to go tomorrow? And David's saying, well, I'm like fully expecting significant number of walkouts. it absolutely terrified me that when I first heard it. And then there may have been a couple of walkouts from it, but as soon as I saw his pleasure in thinking that there were going to be walkouts, it really made a kind of big effect on me. And
what kind of effect?
It made it seem more appealing.
Why? It's not usually what people pray for about their movies.
It's kind of like, I don't know, you're always, if you're chasing after people, getting them to like you, you're always going to be unsatisfied. Whereas if you team up with people who throw caution to the wind about their work and are entirely unconcerned, because I'm just not really that kind of person. So I like being around that energy when people are just, if they get an opportunity to make a movie, they're going to make exactly the movie that they want to make. And it's regardless of the audience, regardless of anything, it's almost like they're like pirates. I mean, they're like a sort of Robin Hood. Then someone's given them financing for a movie and they're gonna make whatever they want to make, and if an audience likes it, that's great, but it's not their major concern at all.
So since it's Twilight that made you famous, let's hear a scene from the first Twilight film, and you're a vampire who's been 17 years old for God knows how many centuries. And then you meet Bella, played by Kristen Stewart, who you fall in love with, and she falls in love with you. And after revealing to her that you're a vampire, you warn her about how dangerous you are. And this is the scene in which you're warning her, and all the swoosh sounds that we're hearing in the background, this is as you're demonstrating to her visually how strong and powerful you are, and how you're capable of flying around, disappearing from one place, and then a moment later reappearing in another. So here is Robert Pattinson and Kristen Stewart.
I'm the world's most dangerous predator. Everything about me invites you in. My voice, my face, even my smell. As if I wouldn't need any of that.
Because if you can outrun me, as if you could fight me off, I'm designed to kill.
I don't care.
I've killed people before.
It does not matter.
I wanted to kill you. I've never wanted a human's blood so much in my life.
I trust you.
Don't.
I'm here. I trust you.
My family, we're different from others of our kind. We only hunt animals. We learn to control our thirst. But it's you. Your scent. It's like a drug to me. Like my own personal brand of heroin.
You smell real good.
I love how, like, your character is this, like, brew of, like, toxic masculinity and the seductive, dangerous young man mixed with a sensitive young man trying hard not to lose control of his impulses and be very responsible. What's your psychosexual analysis of your character?
Oof. I mean, I guess, yeah, the context has changed. I mean, I remember when I was doing it, I think what I was thinking was the danger of when you fall in love with someone, to the instinct to build a pedestal higher and higher and higher and higher, and suddenly, and it was something to do with I clearly round up everything to being every character I play is some kind of self-doubt issue, but I thought when he falls in love with Bella, it makes him feel weaker and weaker and weaker, and she becomes this kind of enormous she becomes his fantasy figure, and that's what's terrifying him, is making him feel weaker and weaker. The psychosexual stuff, I mean, I'm kind of, I don't know, there was something, I remember watching Lust Caution. I was very, very obsessed with that movie when I was doing the first Twilight, and it's kind of, I always kind of imagined that thing, especially in movies, because the intent, the tiniest individual touch or just presence, you know, if you're in each other's presence, just very, very briefly in these tiny little moments, they become so magnified in cinema that I wanted to make it even less about them holding hands or anything. I mean, I wanted them to only touch like three times in the entire movie, and they just sort of, and those three times are so sort of electrifying, and it's painful to them. Like it's not a particularly pleasurable thing, that how much they're attracted to each other. It's just it's almost traumatic, which is kind of probably how I felt about all my teenage relationships.
Well, I guess the more taboo it is, the more like electric it becomes.
Yeah, it's way better. It's really difficult to generate that when you get older.
I think it's hilarious, actually, that, you know, you work with Werner Herzog, and mm-hmm. he made this great vampire film, Nosferatu, mm-hmm. and not the silent version of Nosferatu, but a Nosferatu starring Klaus Kinski. That's one of, like, the darkest films, and his version of the vampire is somebody who is living forever and doesn't much like the idea. You know, he mm-hmm. there's no pleasure in his life, and he's kind of hideous, and like the plague follows him wherever he goes. And you're this like kind of romantic, you know, mm-hmm. like if Montgomery Clift was a vampire, you know. So it's just like two completely opposite visions of the vampire.
I think Edward basically is Nosferatu, but at the same time, he still cares about like doing his hair and stuff.
Klaus Kinski has no hair in Nosferatu.
Because he is kind of a sort of, Yeah, that was the one thing. That was the kind of massive bone of contention I had when I was doing Twilight. It's like, okay, so they've lived for 100 years. Why are they still going to high school?
Because he's always 17. He's 17 forever.
But even, I mean, people drop out of high school when normal people drop out of high school. Like, it's like, what is he hoping to achieve? He's in the same year.
Same school, right?
Yeah.
So if your vampire was 17 forever, how old were you when you played him?
I was... I think I started when I was 21, mm-hmm. 21, two, and I finished when I was 26. Mm-hmm.
What was it like for you when fame hit?
I mean, it's funny because it was so sudden. I'd done the movie and I was in LA just doing auditions and stuff. And then we did Comic-Con in 2008, and it was literally from having absolutely no one recognize you whatsoever. We went into the big Hall H in San Diego, and it was like being in Backstreet Boys, just immediately. I mean, like from you walked through the door, and it was just down the rabbit hole, and. But it was so sudden, it didn't feel real to me at all. I mean, it was like, and I think I'm really happy I had that first kind of brush with it all like that, because it seemed so surreal that I felt like I'd gone to pay to see a show of people all screaming and going crazy, and it was nothing to do with me whatsoever. And so, I mean, I kind of always felt like that the whole way through it. I mean, it felt so sudden that I didn't feel the weight of responsibility with it at all.
So, getting back to Twilight for a moment, you and your co-star Kristen Stewart were a couple for several years. When she hosted Saturday Night Live in 2017, she referred to that in her opening monologue, which was hilarious. So here's an excerpt of it.
I'm a little nervous to be hosting because I know that the president's probably watching, and I don't think he likes me that much. Here's how I know. 4 years ago, I was dating this guy named Rob, Robert. And we broke up, and then we got back together, and for some reason, it made Donald Trump go insane. Here's what he actually tweeted, and this is real. Robert Pattinson should not take back Kristen Stewart. She cheated on him like a dog and will do it again. Just watch, he can do so much better. Now, I know what you're thinking, right? That's so crazy. The president tweeted about you once. No, no, no. The president tweeted about me 11 times. He also said, everyone knows I'm right, that Robert Pattinson should dump Kristen Stewart. In a couple years, he'll thank me. Be smart, Robert. I know. And then one day later, he tweeted, everyone's asking me to speak more on Robert and Kristen, and I don't have time, except to say, Robert, drop her. She cheated on you, and she'll do it again. Okay, so to be fair, I don't think Donald Trump hated me. I think he's in love with my boyfriend. Because he also tweeted this. Miss Universe 2012 pageant will be airing live on NBC and Telemundo December 19th. Open invite stands for Robert Pattinson. So yeah, that's crazy, right? The president is not a huge fan of me. But that is so okay. And Donald, if you didn't like me then, you're really probably not going to like me now because I'm hosting SNL and I'm like so gay, dude.
So that was Kristen Stewart's opening monologue on Saturday Night Live. So there's one other Miss Universe reference I want to mention from a Donald Trump tweet from 2012. Robert, I'm getting a lot of heat for saying you should dump Kristen, but I'm right. If you saw the Miss Universe girls, you would reconsider. it's so great. Like, he's plugging his beauty pageant and making it sound like you should be shopping for a girl from my catalog of beauty, you know, of pageant contestants. Like, I'll show you them. You can choose. You can have one. So we heard a little bit of Kristen Stewart's reaction to all of that. What was your reaction to the tweets?
Again, I literally feel like I have a kind of alter ego who's living that existence. I mean, it's just kind of, I don't feel like it's in any way in reference to me in reality at all. I mean, I think it's just an impossible thing to compute. I mean, especially now. I mean, at the time, I wasn't even really paying attention to it at all.
Well, he wasn't president yet. But he's president now.
And it is kind of fascinating. I think I actually, a while ago, checked, and I think he might have deleted all those tweets, and I'm like, hey, what's all that about? You over it now?
You feel hurt?
Yeah, I'm like, that's my claim to fame.
Your first jobs that resembled acting was modeling. You started modeling when you were 12. What were you modeling for at age 12? I mean, like, what kinds of products? The clothing?
I used to do women's hand modeling.
Oh, you're kidding me.
Yeah, that was the first couple. That was the first couple of jobs for jewelry.
Explain what hand modeling is.
for like catalog rings and stuff.
So the beautiful engagement ring would actually be on your hand?
It'd actually be 12-year-old me. I only did that once. But I definitely liked that.
How did you get that job?
I don't know, actually. I think it was sort of like an accident. I just had a
quite large... I could see all these like women coming to audition and a 12-year-old boy and he gets the job.
The patriarchy. Snatches another one. That's only happened once. I think I might have only got about $50 for it too. I did that. I got very, very few jobs. I did like going to the castings, though. It was always kind of fun. It was definitely access to a world that I would never have had access to otherwise. And then to transition from that to doing acting auditions, it was just... I mean, I remember the first acting audition I did after having done thousands of modeling castings where you line up for hours and they don't even look at you. They just look at your book of photos and they just say no. And then you do an acting audition and you're actually... You know, people are asking you questions and stuff. I mean, it just seemed so... it was night and day. And I mean, I think my first audition, I think, was for Troy, the Brad Pitt movie. And I just thought it was so fun, even the audition, and just wild that anyone was even listening to me do any of this stuff.
I think some people were probably initially surprised to hear you... Like, people who first knew you from Twilight were surprised to hear your British accent when you spoke as yourself. Mm-hmm. You're good at accents. You've done plenty of them. You also sing and play music, and I always think a musician's ear and an actor's ear are similar in being able to do, like, accents and, you know, mimic voices and stuff. But how did you teach yourself how to do accents? Or is that just a gift that you had?
I think, especially with American accents, it's probably definitely from singing and I did genuinely really want to be a rapper when I was a kid, and so I used to obsessively listen to that and on all the kind of 90s and early 2000s rap records. They always used to have these kind of interludes with like little skits on the album.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember like with me and my friends after school would always try and record those, like make our own little ones of those. And still to this day, I mean, whenever I'm doing a movie or a character in an English accent, I mean, I find it almost, I literally feel like I'm naked and I'm incapable of doing my normal voice in a character. It just doesn't come out at all. It's every single time I read something, the first thing to change is something to do with my voice. It just does it naturally. I find a kind of deep pleasure in doing accents as well. It's kind of, especially there's something like The Lighthouse where, I mean, the more you practice it, there's just certain syllables that are really fun. It's really satisfying to say, and it's kind of when you're trying to get something to sound right, it's like tuning guitar strings, and you kind of, you know, you can listen to a bunch of examples of the accent you're trying to do, and then when you're practicing and practicing and practicing, repeating a line, eventually the two, you know, your idea and the sound comes in harmony with each other. It's a very, very satisfying feeling.
Robert Pattinson, it's been great to talk with you. Thank you so much.
Cool, thank you so much. Thanks for having me.
Robert Pattinson stars in the new films The Lighthouse, which is in theaters, and The King, which is on Netflix.